I stumbled onto this song on YouTube the other day, and I rejoiced. I hadn't heard this song in 30, 35 years. Whatever happened to Mac Davis? Lubbock, Texas, in my rearview mirror. Great song. I don't care if you're country or rock and roll. This is just a great piece of music. Whatever happened to good old Mac Davis? All right, we are going to head into some very interesting territory in just a few moments. After completing his groundbreaking research chronicled in DMT, the spirit molecule, Dr. Rick Strassman was left with one fundamental question. What does it mean that DMT, a simple chemical naturally found in all of our bodies, instantaneously opens up to us an interactive spirit world that feels more real than our own world? When his decades of clinical psychiatric research and Buddhist practice were unable to provide answers to this question, Strassman began searching for a more resonant spiritual model. He found that the visions of the Hebrew prophets, such as Ezekiel, Moses, Adam, and Daniel, were strikingly similar to those of the volunteers in his DMT studies. Carefully examining the concept of prophecy in the Hebrew Bible, he characterizes a prophetic state of consciousness and explains how it may share biological and metaphysical mechanisms with the DMT experience. My conversation with Dr. Rick Strassman, author of DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, when Coast to Coast AM continues. Rick Strassman is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine and president and co-founder of the Cottonwood Research Foundation. From 1990 to 1995, he performed the first new human studies with psychedelic drugs in the United States in more than 20 years, focusing on the powerful, naturally occurring compound DMT. The author of DMT, the Spirit Molecule, and co-author of Inner Paths to Outer Space, he lives in Gallup, New Mexico, and his new book, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. Rick Strassman, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Good, Richard. Thanks for having me on tonight.
And it's a festival of Ricks and Richards, so I appreciate you hanging out with us for the next 3 hours. First of all, dimethyltryptamine. I stumbled over that, even though I've been practicing it all week. Now, what is it exactly? I mean, I alluded to it off the top of the show tonight, but give us a more exact definition.
Well, it's a compound. It's a relatively small molecule, not much larger than glucose. It's made from tryptophan, dietary tryptophan, which is a ubiquitous amino acid. It is just a few metabolic steps required from tryptophan to tryptamine, and then the body attaches two methyl groups to tryptamine to make dimethyltryptamine, or DMT. It was first determined to be in psychedelic plants from Latin America in the late 1940s, and then it was discovered to be psychedelic in humans about 10 years after that, in Hungary, actually. And then a few years after that, it was discovered to exist in the body fluids and tissues of lower animals, and then a few years later, it was discovered in the body fluids of humans as well, blood, spinal fluid, and urine. So it is the first compound with, you know, psychedelic properties that was discovered to be naturally made in the human body.
Well, before I get a definition, before we get a definition of what psychedelic means, because that may mean different things to different people, but what does it say about the world we live in that this compound, this simple compound, as you described it, is so ubiquitous? It's in plants, it's in animals.
Well, it seems to indicate that it's got a widespread purpose. It's unclear what its purpose is in plants. I suppose if a plant will exert certain kinds of responses in humans, which humans value, then one could suppose that would provide for some evolutionary advantage to that plant. because it would be revered and cultured and protected. In terms of its role in the animal kingdom, that still is being worked out. It's quite interesting in terms of the importance or the seeming importance of DMT to the human brain, on the brain of, so the brain of any mammals that have been studied to date, is that DMT appears to be actively transported into the brain using the brain's energy, and only a very small number of compounds are treated that way, compounds which are required for normal brain function, like blood sugar, for example, and certain amino acids. In other words, it appears that DMT may be necessary for normal brain function.
If that's the case, is that the reason before the Controlled Substances Act came down in the early 70s, and a lot of these studies were verboten? But is that the reason why DMT, as it is naturally occurring in the human brain, was studied? What were they looking for originally?
It was a pretty obscure drug compared to LSD during the first wave of human psychedelic research. But things changed after its discovery in human body fluids, because it is a compound which is quite psychedelic, and it's also made in the body. And so that began an intensive study of the potential role of DMT in psychosis, especially schizophrenia. Psychiatric researchers believed if DMT caused a schizophrenic-like state, then if you could block the effects of DMT, understand the biology of DMT, even perhaps reduce or prevent the synthesis of DMT, it might possibly have antipsychotic effects. It was interesting, though, because nobody was looking at other altered states of consciousness with more positive connotations, like mystical states, states resulting from meditation, which could possibly be related to naturally occurring DMT.
Rick Strassman is my guest here on Coast to Coast AM. The book DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, which is sort of the follow-up to the spirit molecule. Now, let's work in another definition here, Rick, and that is, what do we mean by a psychedelic?
Yeah, the psychedelic, drugs or compounds which induce a constellation of psychological effects in a fairly reliable manner. The unique thing about the psychedelics is that they impact every aspect of consciousness, as opposed to just specific mental functions like the amphetamines, let's say, or the benzodiazepines. In the case of the psychedelics, there are alterations in perception, especially visual perception, auditory effects, there's emotional effects, either ecstasy or terror, cognitive effects, one thinks more quickly or more slowly or develops new insights. There's specific kinds of physical effects, you feel cold or warm or light or heavy, and also these compounds will exert effects on the will, being able to interact with oneself or the outside world in a different manner.
Is it possible that, first of all, where do we know is DMT produced in the human body? Is it in the pineal gland or is it somewhere else?
It's primarily made in the lungs. In the DMT book, the spirit molecule, I speculate about the pineal gland, and actually A year ago, a group in Ann Arbor, Michigan, discovered DMT in the living rodent's pineal gland. But in the meantime, it's been known for almost 50 years that the lungs make DMT.
That's interesting. Now, let's get into your study. We'll dial back to the early 90s. And again, this was the first time in 20 years that any new studies revolving around psychedelic drugs and on human subjects was performed. Why 20 years?
Well, it was as a result of the passage of the Controlled Substances Act in 1970, which effectively put the kibosh on any human studies. Up until then, starting in the late 1940s with the discovery of LSD, psychiatric research was quite enamored with these drugs. Small amounts of LSD could cause tremendously intense, changes in human consciousness. And up until that time, it was the most potent mind-altering, chemical known. And also, serotonin was discovered around the same time. And it was determined that LSD is closely related pharmacologically to serotonin. So LSD, in a lot of ways, opened up the entire study of biological psychiatry. The relationship between the brain and mental states. And so, quite a few studies occurred with these drugs for 20, 25 years or so. But then the drugs escaped from the laboratory, as it were, and so people were using them in an uncontrolled manner in a huge scale. And, there were emergency room visits and suicides and all kinds of adverse effects in unprepared, poorly supervised, people just experimenting with these drugs willy-nilly. And as a result, the government determined it was a, public health problem. So they clamped, down on human studies as a result of, making the possession and the use of these drugs illegal. There were some irresponsible researchers, too, so the regulations for doing approved human work, through the government also became extremely difficult. So human studies stopped, with the passage of that legislation. In the meantime, though, studies in lower animals continued, and all of the breakthroughs in serotonin receptor physiology resulting in, the new antidepressants, unlike Prozac, and the new antipsychotic drugs all continued apace. Most of them, were related to studies of psychedelics in lower animals.
How does a compound, a chemical compound that is naturally occurring in the body, like DMT, become a controlled substance any more than serotonin or melatonin?
Well, the concentrations that are occurring in the human body most of the time are extremely low. So it's a combination of the dose and, the effects. If you take a large amount of DMT, it is acutely disabling. So that was the basis of it being scheduled like LSD.
So how were you able to get permission to conduct these new human studies using DMT if none had been done previously in 20 years? How did you manage to get around the system?
I spent a lot of time training and preparing. I went to medical school in order to become a psychiatrist in order to do psychedelic drug research. I took some extra training in clinical psychopharmacology research. I also had, begun my clinical research career studying melatonin, and I had gotten some grants and published papers, for that study. So by the time I began applying for my permits and grants, I was, pretty well trained and, pretty well positioned as an independent, clinical researcher. A few years, before I started the application process, I had written a review on the the adverse effects of psychedelics. I had read hundreds of papers, and I had published a review article, concluding that if you screen and supervise and follow up human volunteers, you can give these drugs in a safe manner. So I approached this study in a kind of banal manner, in a lot of ways, by stating it had been a long time since human studies had occurred. All of this animal data had accumulated, and it was important, to confirm or, to refute animal data, regarding the biology of the psychedelics. I pointed out, the fact that DMT is a prototypical psychedelic drug, and humans are, people were still taking psychedelics, and we really didn't understand what they were doing. Finally, I kind of unearthed, the whole psychosis and, DMT story, speculating that if we understood, more about DMT, it could shed some light on, naturally occurring, psychosis.
Or things like near-death experiences or other mystical experiences. We've just got a couple minutes here before we break at the bottom of the hour, but let's begin the discussion and talk about, we'll dial back to 1990 and again, these human tests. How many subjects in the test, in the study rather, how many human subjects in the study, how were they selected?
Well, I ran the study from 90 to 95, and in that period of time we studied around 60 people. And we gave a number of different doses of the drug, small, medium, and high. And, the cumulative number of doses all those volunteers got was around 400 or so.
And forgive my naivete, never having dabbled in or partaken in ayahuasca or anything like that. How does one administer DMT? Is it an IV drip? Is it? Do you smoke it? Do you take it in pill form? How?
Yeah, it's smoked on the street, or it's vaporized and inhaled on the street if you're just using it recreationally, but using it that way on a research unit would have been unwieldy, so we gave it intramuscularly at first to one volunteer, but he compared it to be quite slow compared to the smoked route. He had smoked it previously, so we ended up giving it intravenously.
And it's interesting in this study, you wanted subjects who had prior experience with DMT. Why is that?
Well, more generally, I wanted volunteers who had experience taking, psychedelics. DMT at the time was pretty obscure. Only, two or three of the volunteers had previously used DMT. But terms of their being experienced, with other psychedelics. It was important because of the issues of informed consent. You want to tell people they're getting a psychedelic drug. And if you have no idea, what that means, it can be quite startling, and you'd be unprepared. I also, believed experienced users would be, more able, to carefully characterize the effects. And also, they would be less, prone to panic. Because of their, familiarity with the state in general in the first place.
All right. We'll take a time out here. And when we come back, I want to delve further into how these studies were conducted and some of the experiences of your subjects. Also, maybe you could sort of help us understand what it's like to experience this psychedelic DMT. Dr. Rick Strassman, author of DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, a new science of spiritual revelation in the Hebrew Bible, as Sting takes us out with King of Pain. Hey, welcome back to Coast AM, the website, richardserrett.com, and please say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, as Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band brings us back in with Kathmandu. You could go to Kathmandu for some spiritual enlightenment, or you could just stay right here and continue to listen to this conversation with my guest, Dr. Rick Strassman, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, which is a follow-up to quite a remarkable book dealing with the spirit molecule, DMT and the spirit molecule. And in this latest work, he details how he came to the Hebrew Bible's model of prophecy, the Old Testament, as a way to understand the psychedelic DMT effect. And we'll discuss his personal journey from being raised in a conservative Jewish home into Zen Buddhism and then back, circling all the way back to the Hebrew Bible. Back with more of my conversation with Rick Strassman, reminding us what a long, strange trip it's been. And we are back with Rick Strassman, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, a new science of spiritual revelation in the Hebrew Bible. And before we delve into, you know, some of the physiological effects, the subjective effects and so forth, cognitive effects of DMT, let's talk a little bit about, a bit more about the conditions under which this study was conducted with these 60-odd subjects going back from 1990 to 1995. So take us back there. Set the stage for us. What did you do with these subjects?
Well, it was an extensive screening procedure. You know, people would either call me or my research nurse, and I would ask them if, you know, some standard questions, their age, their gender, if they were employed, married, those kinds of things. And, you know, I had to begin by asking them if they were experienced using psychedelic drugs. I asked them if there were any ongoing health problems I ought to be aware of. And, you know, then I would have them come into my office. And, you know, we would spend up to an hour or two, you know, discussing their interest in the study, their background with these drugs, you know, what they hope to get out of participating. And I would give them some, you know, some preparation as to what to expect. But, you know, mostly I wanted people to have their own trips, you know, so to speak. You know, so I just mostly, you know, told people it was quite a quick experience. It starts fast, peaks quickly, and is over in maybe a half hour or so. And also that it's, you know, commonly described as out of body. In other words, you're, you know, there is, you know, the sensation of your consciousness leaving your body. You know, so I, you know, felt those were, you know, really the, you know, two only requirements, you know, regarding, you know, how much, you know, to tell people what to expect. And, you know, so then we screened them, you know, physically. I, you know, performed a, you know, physical exam and, you know, some laboratory screening tests, blood counting, chemistries, and, you know, cardiogram. You know, then afterwards, if everything was okay, they would come in for a couple of screening doses of drug. You know, they were non-blind, you know, dose administrations. In other words, I knew what the amount of drug they were getting, and, you know, so did the volunteer. You know, so we gave a small dose first, and if everything went well, they would come in the next day for, you know, for the larger dose. Yeah, and, you know, they were laying in a hospital bed in a busy research unit in a university hospital. It all took place at the University of New Mexico Hospital in Albuquerque. And we gave the drug intravenously. And also, you know, we were drawing blood from another vein in another arm in order to collect, you know, blood samples, you know, to measure the concentrations of a number of different hormones, you know, that we were expecting, you know, might increase as a result of getting DMT. We were checking their blood pressure and their pulse on a regular basis, you know, using one of those blood pressure machines. We also, you know, we're measuring a core temperature, you know, with a little, you know, rectal thermometer that was in place. You know, so they were completely wired, you know, in a lot of ways, it you know, was the most unpleasant imaginable, you know, kind of setting, you know, to experience a mind-altering, you know, drug experience. You know, but at the same time, They were completely safe. If any cardiacs, problems occurred, there was a crash cart and a crash team right nearby. So we could respond to any kind of emergencies. The drug effect was so short. It was tolerable as well because it was all over within a half hour.
And you're taking copious notes. You're sitting there scribbling notes like there's no tomorrow.
In response, to the higher dose, people were incapable of communicating. They were stock still, just, lying there. But then after they came out of it, maybe at the 15 to 20 minute point, then we started, to discuss, their session. And I took a lot of notes. So we would spend about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, after they had come down, we covered every manner of experience that they had, we would also, discuss, psychological issues, spiritual issues, pretty much anything that would come up as a result.
Sure.
Of the drug.
Sure. Sure. And for those who the closest they've gotten to a psychedelic experiment would be or experience would be listening to Jefferson Airplane. Describe the physical sensation of undergoing or taking DMT. What happens?
So I would infuse the drug over the space of about a half of a minute, and within the space of maybe 20 seconds or so, you would start to, feel the effect. And it was what most of the volunteers described as a rush, an intense, feeling of pressure and acceleration, both, psychologically as and physically. Some anxiety, but they were prepared for it. That feeling of inner speed and of inner pressure would climax in the space of about a minute or so, people would describe a separation of their consciousness from their body. The first minute or so, there would be extremely rapidly moving, intensely colored visual effects, and those peaked also at about the 1 minute to 2 minute point, at around the same time of the separation of one's consciousness, at which point people described being in a world of light, extremely bright, rapidly moving, and the colors were intensely saturated. Oftentimes, there was a feeling of ecstasy. There were some sounds, perhaps like a ringing bell or crinkling cellophane. Music of a spiritual or even kind of an angel-like, musical score.
Sure. Sure. So, aside from auditory effects, how about visual effects, Dr. Strassman?
Yeah, so people, would enter into this world of light, and, they would start to discern images or, formed images in the content. There would be all manner of recognizable things, plants, animals, humanoids, furniture, space, stars, planets, machines, all kinds of things, which emerged, from this, rapidly moving, matrix of colors, which, constituted this, world of light, that they had entered into.
And were they, with the subjects, that is, were they interacting with these, what we'll call these visual effects?
Yes. That was an interesting aspect of the whole study, is, the highly interactive you know, nature of the experiences. Because I was, you know, coming at the spiritual, you know, properties, and also I was coming at, you know, what the peak effect of the drug might be, you know, from the Buddhist perspective of the enlightenment experience, expecting, you know, people to, you know, merge into the white light. You know, there would no, you know, there would be no personality. There wouldn't be any form or images or ideas or content. But instead, you know, the volunteers were interacting with these things. In the case of the sentient beings, as it were, you know, there was communication. You know, there was answering questions, and they're asking, you know, questions. They were able to, you know, negotiate in that space. You know, pay careful attention, you know, to what they were seeing. You know, remember in extremely good detail, you know, all that transpired.
You mentioned Buddhism and Zen, and it's always been curious to me why is it that we tend to associate psychedelics with sort of Eastern mysticism? What is that connection?
Well, you know, it's a you know, complicated issue, and I do spend some time in, you know, the new book talking about that. Some of it is historical. You know, the psychedelics, you know, kind of, you know, burst into Western consciousness in the 60s. And, you know, that was the same time that meditation also started making inroads into Western consciousness. You know, so, you know, there were two, you know, brand new technologies that were, you know, that were, you know, quite reliable in occasioning extremely altered states of consciousness. You know, so historically they kind of went hand in hand. And I think, you know, the emphasis on altered states that, you know, that, you know, that occurs in the Eastern religious, you know, traditions, you know, they speak about, you know, visions and, you know, voices as a result of specific, you know, types of meditation. And, you know, so it was part of the vocabulary, you know, of meditation, as opposed, you know, to the, you know, more traditional religious institutions at the time, like Christianity or Judaism. You know, so the vocabulary was there, the interest was there. And also, you know, you can't overlook the novelty aspect. Because the psychedelics are extremely novel, the states of mind that they lead to. And, you know, so as I think, you know, there is a tendency, you know, to conflate the two new things, as opposed to looking for explanations for the psychedelic state in the stodgy old establishment, you know, spiritual traditions, you know, that people were coming out of.
I just want to take a little bit of a side road here, because this is an interesting aspect of the story, and that is your journey, because you were raised in a conservative Jewish home. You gravitated towards Buddhism, and what you ended up finding is that the Buddhism or Eastern mysticism, or even the shamanistic traditions from Latin or South America, weren't adequate to explain what was happening to these subjects that were given DMT. So, I mean, tell me, just spend a few moments and talk to me about your journey from a Jewish conservative, or a conservative Jew rather, to Zen Buddhism and then back again.
It was a roundabout journey, so to speak. Yeah, I started off Jewish. I was raised in a conservative, you know, household. And I learned Hebrew, and I learned about Israel, and I learned about God some, you know, but there was still a, you know, lack of any true spirituality in the Judaism that I was learning. You know, one of our, you know, teachers, you know, taught us, you know, simple meditation, you know, surreptitiously, I think, you know, but, you know, that was only, you know, a small amount of, you know, our experience in, you know, I'm within Hebrew school. Yeah, I spent, you know, 6 hours a week outside of, you know, public school going to Hebrew school, you know, from the age of, you know, 5 to 13. And, you know, I enjoyed, you know, studying and, you know, reading Hebrew, you know, but there wasn't any spiritual nourishment involved. You know, so after, you know, I turned 13 and was bar mitzvahed, I kind of, you know, drifted away. You know, but I still was interested in spiritual things, you know, spiritual experience, dreams, altered states. As a kid, I used to make fireworks, you know, so I always liked, you know, bright lights and, you know, the excitement, you know, from making fireworks. You know, there was a hunger, you know, for, you know, something other than the ordinary everyday. And in college, I learned, you know, transcendental meditation, which was kind of tame. And I, you know, wasn't quite, you know, stimulated, you know, by, you know, the Hindu, you know, tradition. You know, seemed too flowery and, you know, too complicated, you know, for me at the time. Yeah, so I, you know, gradually gravitated towards, you know, Buddhism, especially Zen. I found a teacher and I found a community. You know, so they had, you know, they were addressing, you know, spiritual issues, you know, meditation, altered states, you know, near-death states, you know, mystical states. And, you know, they were coming at it from a, you know, sober, you know, level-headed, you know, kind of, you know, simple, not especially complicated approach. You know, but quite intellectual at the same time. But, you know, I'm also, you know, rather straightforward and, you know, quite practical. And I like my teacher. I like the other, you know, students at the temple. You know, it was extremely interesting, you know, because in college I was quite, you know, keen on, you know, comparing, you know, states of meditation with the states resulting from taking psychedelics. And in you know, so every chance I got, you know, when I was at the monastery, I would ask, you know, the junior monks if, you know, they were experienced, you know, taking LSD. And almost all of them were, you know, before they had, you know, become monks. And almost every one of them also was quite clear in, you know, their belief, you know, that their LSD experiences, you know, gave them a glimpse of enlightenment and was the stimulus, you know, to become a monk and undergo religious training.
But how would a, we're just heading into a break here and we'll begin the discussion now and continue on later, but how does the Buddhist tradition approach what your subjects were revealing to you under the influence of DMT? Would the Buddhists say that this was just a product of the mind, or would they say, no, what they're experiencing, this other level of reality is real?
Yeah, that's an extremely, you know, both complicated and, you know, controversial issue. The simple answer is, you know, that, you know, Buddhism, you know, treats any, you know, contents of the mind as illusory. As hallucinatory, including, you know, any, you know, which are occasioned by drugs. There's also quite strict prescriptions against using most mind-altering, you know, drugs within the Buddhist tradition.
And so when we come back, we'll talk about, you know, what your mindset was and how you were reacting to what these subjects were telling you under the influence of DMT, and whether or not you thought this was simply a product of the mind or whether this was real. What they were experiencing was real. My conversation with Dr. Rick Strassman, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, as the Beatles take us out with I'm Looking Through You, here on Coast to Coast AM.